Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
And to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own.
Michael Hohmeyer with us, and it's the last segment of Dresser After Dark. Michael, welcome back.
Yeah.
I know you're there.
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you. Fine. How are you?
I am super. How are you?
Okay. I was fine until they started negotiating the budget deal, and that the president wants to cut down on these entitlement programs and let us cut Medicare. Let's cut it out to a point where nobody gets anything if they're over 65. But if you want a cell phone and you are in the poverty level, you can get a free cell phone. Did you know that?
Yeah, talk about misguided priorities.
Yeah, I don't quite understand the thinking. And if you're going to cut from everybody, there's something called entitlement, but as a senior citizen, is Medicare entitlement? And have we not paid for that through Social Security for all the years?
Exactly. That's why there is talk on the other side of the aisle. Among the Republicans, the Ryan plan says the changes that we need to make to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are going to need to be phased in. The people who are close to the age when they can start deriving benefits, there's not going to be any change for them. The other folks who are not as old, if you will, the switchover is going to be phased in. For some people, they're going to be on a modified version of the existing plan, and for others, there's going to be privatization or other options made available to them. That comes much closer to achieving fairness because it's a discretionary program that takes into account the differences that people have based on age or contributions into the system, so that you're not getting people who are 64 and about to retire and suddenly they get the game changed on them to the last minute, the goalposts moved, and somebody says, oh, you got to stay work until you're 70. That's just not fair.
No, it's not fair at all. And then the other side of that is Social Security. Whatever that was, Social Security. You know what that was? That was a thunderstorm that's not a thunderstorm. Somehow I didn't turn down the weather channel. Did you hear something go, wow?
I certainly did. It sounded like thunder to me over where you are.
Yeah, but it's not really thunder. It's the weather channel, and I've got to get the volume down on that thing. But so if you hear it every once in a while, it's really the White House. They're after us again. But here's my contention.
Doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, I got that. Get the tinfoil on. We'll get the rays stopped, and we'll be okay. Now, here's where I think there's a problem. If I am in a poverty position, all right, somehow I can possibly find a job. If I really want to find something, even the nominal, I can go out and find something to do where somebody will give me a couple of bucks to do it. But at the same time, if you're 65, 70 years old and you get sick, what do you do then? Do you just give it up and say, I'm going to go someplace and die? If you don't have the backup and the insurance to do what it'll take to keep you healthy, I think that in and of itself is where the problem lies. They're not looking at this in a practical, logical way. And I think Sarah Palin said it. It's a, it's a death sentence.
Absolutely. And that can't be allowed to be the fix that is adopted to change this system that currently exists. We know the system that currently exists is going broke, or it's going to send us all broke. So
sure,
it needs to be fixed. The way to fix it, though, has to be one that's not only a practical fix, in other words, that it actually fixes the problem, but also it is fair, that it doesn't work just for the people already in the system and leave them alone. It doesn't work for the folks who are 20 in their 20s and 30s who haven't really invested that much time and money into the system. So if you change it on them, it's not that unfair. The people in the middle need to be taken care of. That seems to be the intent of Congressman Ryan's plan. even in the form that it's in currently, it recognizes the fact that you have to treat the people who are coming up on the cusp in a way that's fair so they don't get stuck having spent 40, 45 years paying into a system, expecting it to be a certain way, and possibly supplementing it because they had their doubts as to whether the system would be there, but making sure they don't get left suddenly with the rug pulled out from underneath them, and they don't have the years, as you suggest, to go out and start another career and build up another retirement nest egg.
No, absolutely. And the other thing that's out of balance here, and I don't know if we could call it fair or unfair, whatever the case may be, the president of the United States, whoever it is since the 90s, gets $400,000 a year with a $50,000 built in for expenses, not counting the plane rides and the rest of it. The average congressperson gets somewhere around, I think it's like $195,000 a year, plus some perks, obviously. So
I'd give him a raise.
Yeah, of course. Now, where are
Seriously,
they getting?
I'd put them all up to $250,000 because that seems to be the level at which, the threshold of where the rich are, and that we're only going to tax the rich. I would make all those folks up there and see if at the end of the new tax system coming in, they're actually netting more or less money afterwards.
And by the way, I completely agree with that aspect of it. But when we're talking cuts. And I hear you, Michael, and I happen to be on your side with that one. But when we're talking cuts, it's very easy to cut someone else. There's where the problem lies. We'll cut this, we'll cut that, but we're not going to get cut. Once they retire, there's a tremendous amount of money that they retire on with all of the perks. They never have to worry about it again, even if they serve one term. So in essence, what we're dealing with are people who are not looking at themselves, but they're looking at everybody, quote unquote, underneath them. That's where it has to change. What has to change is they have to become statespeople. I'm very politically correct tonight. Statesmen as opposed to politicians. The politician is not what we want. It's the statesman. The statesman whose main cause is to take care of the constituency.
Yes, that's a key distinction. And it is a part of the process we're starting in now. I think you're entirely right. We'll end up separating the men from the boys and the women from the girls, if you will. The idea being we're going to find out who the politicians are and who the statesmen are. Right now, we're at the beginning of the process. Unfortunately, it's going to take some time. There's going to be some blood on the floor. Perhaps that's a good thing. Perhaps it's not. But at the end of the day, we're going to be heading in a different direction. We have to. Otherwise, we, as we've talked about many times, Michael Ray, you and I, we know the direction we're heading in is going over a cliff. We cannot afford to ride the car over the cliff. So we have to go in a different direction, and turning the wheel is going to result in a lot of pain for a lot of people, but it's a necessary evil that we all encounter. And I think there is the political impetus. The mass of the citizenry want it done. They want the system fixed. They know it cannot go on the way it is, and attempting to fix it 10 years from now will be not only worse, but less likely to be successful. So now is the time. It has to be done, and the process will separate the statesmen and women from the politicians.
Another area of concern, another facet of that, Michael, legislation requires cooperation, and we are not getting any cooperation. The liberals are this, and the Republicans are that, and it goes on and on. So the key is to go to the table, values neutral, and go about working on a fix instead of you're right, I'm wrong. I mean, when you take a look at this, Obama, whether he's right or wrong about what he decides he wants to do, and the end result, if he doesn't like what the Republicans are doing, one slash of the pen, and it's over with.
You know, I have a feeling that it's not going to be done by moderates. I think that this is going to be done by two sides with opposite views duking it out, and ultimately the voters decide which of those two contrasting viewpoints they go with. The reason we came so close to a government shutdown is because there is not agreement on these issues between the two sides, and somebody blinked. It was a chicken game, and somebody blinked, and we got the plan that we got. And that was only on finishing off the 2011 budget. This was not a full budget. This wasn't the 2012 budget. This was a non-existent budget that never got passed by the Democrat Congress last year. So this is all just, the 2011 is just kind of like Band-Aids and rubber bands put on something that we're just trying to close out until the next fiscal year comes up. That's where the real battle is going to be on the budget. And I don't see the two sides being reconcilable without there being bloodshed. And I think that the moderates aren't going to be the ones who bring everybody together and tell everyone to compromise. There are going to be people out there saying, there is no more money. We can't afford to spend anymore. We don't have a tax problem. We don't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. And if you don't control spending, it doesn't matter how much or how little revenue you raise, whether it's by big taxes or little taxes or cutting taxes and you increase revenue, you know, even if the Republicans win and they get taxes lowered and that results in an increase of revenue to the government, which should make the liberals happy too, at the end of the day, if you can't stop the runaway government spending, it's always going to be in excess, no matter how much additional revenue you're able to bring in by lowering the tax rates. So really, the spending issue is an obligation on the part of the politicians to behave themselves, to realize that they are spending other people's money, but they need to treat that money as if it's their own, which, of course, is the whole problem with the public employee union and the collective bargaining situation. You've got politicians who are supposed to be representing the people who are, in fact, giving the unions everything the unions want because the unions will support them in their reelection campaigns. It's a conflict of interest because it's not the politicians' money. They need to be made to deal with that money as if it is their own, at least in trust, so that they will behave responsibly with it.
No question about it. And I think one of the bigger problems that we have right now is that it's the way we vote on a president and then Congress, et cetera. This is the way I would love to see the president voted for. And I heard this years ago, and I think it's a great idea. Let's talk about a mayoral vote, okay? You get everybody in the city hall, and you've got five people up there that want to become the mayor. And everybody puts their vote in. Now, the guy with the least amount of votes leaves, and then you go after the next four. And then everybody votes on that four. When I say everybody, the people who voted for the one that left has a revote now. Then you eliminate someone else. And by the time you're done, the most popular person in the room is going to get that particular position. I'd love to see the president of the United States brought in that way.
Well, it would be a very different system than what we have now. And obviously we have a system that exists in order to require that there be geographic segments of the country that buy in, not just popular vote. That's why we have an electoral college to make sure that the president or the candidates for president don't just write off certain geographical areas and exclude them from involvement in the process because arithmetically their votes may not be necessary or there's enough of a margin in certain geographical areas that you can ignore the rest of the country. That does require that candidates for nationwide office campaign in more than just one or two geographic areas. I think that's a good thing, and I think there's some value in seeing if there is a melding of those two that can happen so that there can be this kind of buy-in on the part of the population for the result of the voting while making sure that there are not broad swaths of the national geography that are excluded from the entire process, because the end result to that is you're going to drive people to secede. We've been through that. 150-year anniversary of the start of the American Civil War is upon us. We certainly don't want to see broad swaths of the population being excluded from the process.
Yeah, but here's the point. You brought up an interesting idea here. Being excluded from the process, there's a tremendous amount of people that say they are excluded, and because of that, they get extra perks as being a citizen, and it's not necessarily right. You know, you go all the way back, and the reason for the Electoral College was that we had a population in this country that there were farmers for the most part. There were farmers, there were ranchers. Most of them couldn't read and write, and they didn't know how to make a decision or the best decision for who's going to be running the country. That's why the Electoral College was created, where it's a republic. There are people who are elected. There are people who are elected to make that final vote. So, and we know that it's based on population, based on state, and so on and so forth. Today, sure, we don't have that problem. We have a very sophisticated population here. There isn't anything anybody doesn't know and can't find out. So I think that in and of itself may be one of the reasons that the Electoral College may have seen its own day.
I can understand that. I do believe that part of the reason why politics is changing in its direction right now is very much a consequence of the growth of new media, the alternative media, including your program. We've talked about, you know, the internet, the rise of the internet, and the availability of information from sources other than inside the Beltway media outlets. It's been hugely important. It has enfranchised whole groups of the population. When you see the Tea Party movement as being a grassroots organization that has not been founded by any political party, it just came about by the individual action of millions of people and has turned into a political force, in part because it is not centralized. That's a hugely important development, and it could only happen today with the technology we have, which, as you suggest, might allow for more direct participation in the decision-making on some of these issues. One, as you say, you're right. The big plus of getting people to participate in these decisions is they're invested. It's their decision. They have no one to blame but themselves. On the other hand, part of the reason that folks expect there could be a sea change in the control of the Senate and the presidency next year is because people feel that they were sold a bill of goods. Yes, they voted for the president. Yes, they voted for a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate. But then when they found out what they were getting for what they voted for, now they want to change their votes. Well, they can't take them back, but they can certainly vote in a different direction next year.
Oh, absolutely. You know, democracy obviously is the best system of government. And it's not we don't have a democracy, obviously. We have a republic, which is a representative form of the government. And there are people today that get fed up with all of the arguments and all of the off-centered comments that come through, the Joe Biden's falling asleep in back of the president. I wouldn't want to have been him after that talk. But the point here is avoiding politics makes you more to blame for its failures, not less to blame. And what goes on, people get very confused, and they get so confused with all these mixed media messages that they're getting, Michael, that they don't want any part of it. I've watched people walk out of a room when a particular politician comes on, and it doesn't matter which side of the aisle they're on. The big turnoff, right? Somebody cried, no, I don't like him anymore. And you get this. And if you don't know and you don't participate, then what you get is your responsibility.
Absolutely right. By not voting, you are voting. You are buying into the system, and you're participating even by your absence from participation. There is no non-vote. It's a vote. That's true in business law as much as it is in politics. So I would concur with that, and I would also say that it's something that we advise clients. You need to be engaged, you need to be involved, and you need to have your voice heard, whatever it may happen to be. And our clients, businesses, all of them, or individuals engaged in business also, you know, they all have their perspective, they all have their point of view, but we encourage them to participate actively in the environment. That's what makes their business successful.
That way, they're after us again. The minute you said that, they came to get us. Very quickly, we're starting to run out of time. I completely agree with you. One of the reasons that I'm having to step back and take a look at the way I want to vote, you're a business attorney. You understand that when you're dealing with mergers and acquisitions, it's cash in, cash out. What is somebody going to get based on what they put into a business? It's not what they pay. It's what they're going to get back. The problem that we're having now is the government has turned into a business. It's cash in and cash out. And just like any business, if there's more cash out than cash in, you have a problem. And the people that are running it are not business people. And I'm thinking very seriously if I'll never forget what's his name. Oh, who was that? Why do I keep forgetting his name? Who's going to Hawaii to find out? Going to Hawaii to find out if Obama's got a birth certificate?
Oh, Donald Trump.
Donald Trump. Yes. Donald Trump, whatever he is a businessman. He is a no-nonsense, don't-give-any-garbage businessman. And I'm very seriously thinking if he runs, I may vote for him.
Well, a lot of people feel that way, and part of the reason why he seems to poll so well is because people react to a guy who seems to lay it out there and call it the way he calls it. Even if you don't necessarily agree with all of his positions, he is respected as somebody who is calling it the way he sees it. And people are upset as much with people who lie and don't say what they feel than finding out that the way that this person feels is different or the opposite from what you feel. I mean, I can certainly respect somebody who I disagree with who tells me exactly how he honestly believes. At least you know where he stands. You can have a disagreement an honest disagreement. You can even work towards some kind of compromise when you know where the other person really stands. And people respect Trump because he seems to be calling it the way he really sees it. That's something to be said that is a rarity among all politicians, it seems.
Absolutely. Michael, we're running out of time, but I would love to see Trump and Chris Christie up there, and you would see some very interesting things happen in this country.
That's right. Plain speak, plain talk. That's what people like.
That's what I'm looking for. Website we can find you at?
It's plainly www.homeierlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
You know what I'd like to talk about next week when you come in? Let's talk oil. There's so much oil.
A nice, dirty, but profitable conversation.
Israel has got it. Canada's got it. Mexico's got it. And we have it. And we don't use what we can.
Yep.
And with that, I'll see you next week.
Look forward to it, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
And a loving burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
For now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Listen to these words out there. The words are take it back now. You're going to be hearing a lot about take it back now. And if there's a subject you'd like to hear addressed on the show or someone you'd like to hear interviewed, contact Radio Susie. You can find her right on the homepage of the website. And all of our guests on the guest page, right on the website, just in case you missed the name of a book, a website, or any other contact information.
Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Todd Rutherford with us, founder of the AskThePublishingGuru.com, and as a consultant, he's been involved with the writing, publishing, and marketing of more than 2,500 different books and counting. Todd, welcome back.
Good to be here in the midst of a tornado watch.
Oh, you got a tornado watch over there, don't you? If all of a sudden I hear noise and I don't hear from you, I'll understand it.
Yeah, if I suddenly go silent, that means I'm going into the center of the building.
Yeah, I hear that one loud and clear. As a matter of fact, you guys get a lot of them there, don't you?
Yeah, we're right in Tornado Alley. Definitely have had our history of problems with the wind.
By the way, do you ever get used to it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I don't even... I definitely don't react the same way I used to when I first, was younger and storms were, now we pretty much feel like we're knowledgeable enough, the residents here in the Oklahoma area, we're knowledgeable enough about it that we feel like we could probably even, stand in the face of it and watch it pass by and kind of wave at it.
Yeah, I know people who did that and never seen them again.
We have a lot of storm watchers around here that, crazy as it may seem, they actually have, that's what they do in their spare time is chase storms.
But speaking about chasing storms, authors who get published, authors who have wonderful books, chasing storms, chasing the media is almost like chasing storms. The role that media plays, how important is media in the success of an author's marketing program?
Well, in my opinion, the media is the most important marketing campaign or strategy that you can use. I mean, there are literally John Kramer's book, who is the foremost, expert, considered to be one of the foremost experts in the industry regarding marketing books. His book's called 1,001 Ways to Market Books. And I have all kinds of tabs in mind. It's like the encyclopedia of book marketing. However, out of all of those 1,001 ways, the one way that is the most powerful, the most important thing you can do is publicity. Because if you can get your book or your story, whether it's a work of fiction or a work of nonfiction, you would normally pay for, like, for instance, a 3 to 7, or let's just say a 1 minute radio spot is going to normally run somewhere between, on the low side in a rural community, $10-$15, on the high side in a strong populated area like LA or New York, easily run $300 for a single minute. And so, and yet when you get booked as a guest on a radio show, like I'm a guest on this radio show right now, I'm not paying Michael Ray Dresser anything to be on this show. I'm a guest of your show. I'm providing content to your listeners. The guy that was on before me, the guy that's going to be on after me, they're providing content to the listeners that's educational, entertaining, you know, newsworthy, and in many cases getting 5 to 7 to sometimes even 10 minutes and, you know, of exposure to their story or the information that they have to offer and the availability of their book. Same thing happens in newspapers and magazines. I mean, when you get a book review written in a newspaper or a magazine, or you get a blog to feature your book, I mean, you're potentially getting access to thousands of people, and in some cases, hundreds of thousands. I recently had one of my clients in February that did a 5-minute segment on the Today Show about how to plan a Super Bowl party, and their book was flashed on the screen and exposed to 6.4 million viewers. You can't, there's no way that you could pay for that as an author unless you had millions of dollars, but you can get it for free using publicity. So the media is the most important part of a book marketing strategy.
Now, by the way, there's a difference between a press release and a media pitch. Define the two.
Well, see, one of the most common mistakes that authors make, and even a lot of publicists make who do traditional publicity, and then someone comes to them and says, hey, can you help me promote my book? A press release is when you say, a press release typically is something's happening, here's when it's happening, and here's why it's happening. It's an announcement. But that only works with a book when your book is coming out for the first time. So normally a publicist or an author would put together a press release and say, here's my new book, it's coming out on this date, and here's why I wrote it, and so on. But, or I'm going to be doing this book signing to launch my new book, and here's when it's happening, and here's why I wrote this book, or here's, you know, why it's happening or whatever. Well, that can work for that one particular type of instance. But then how do you get your book coverage after that it's come out for the first time? I've got clients I work with on a regular basis who their book's been out for 5 years, and I'm still booking them coverage in the media in the form of radio interviews, television interviews, newspaper, magazine coverage. And that's the difference between a press release and a media pitch. A media pitch is when you give the journalist or the broadcaster some type of story idea. Because see, what I always tell authors is that the media does not want to help you sell your book. They want to provide content to their readers or listeners. And so if you can pitch a story idea to them, an article idea, an interview idea. I was just talking with a lady earlier today who's written a novel about some urban teenagers that are multiple, different types of teenagers in an urban community from different racial backgrounds and different social backgrounds and cultural backgrounds, and the struggles that they're going through, and they end up banding together and rising above some of the challenges that they've faced in their lives. And it's a novel. And I said, well, that's powerful, but there's a really powerful trend there. I said, this is how I would pitch that book, for example, one pitch that I could come up with right off the top of my head. 5 ways that urban teenagers can make a difference in their local community. And that would be a media pitch. I'm pitching that to a producer of a radio show. Here's something this author can be interviewed. Here's 5 key ideas that this author can be interviewed about that happen to be illustrated in the novel that she wrote. but the principles are what's an interesting topic of discussion for a radio interview or the foundation for an article that could be written by a journalist in a newspaper that's in an urban environment or reaches the urban, you know, an urban culture. So that's the difference between a media pitch and a press release.
Now, by the way, one of the things you said is critically important because it's a slippery slope doing a pitch. I've heard people time and again, Todd, recommend that somebody, and it's a good idea to take what your subject matter is, tie it into something that is current event, which is fine. The problem with that which we know is called the hook, but the problem with that is if you're not prepared for it, the host can confuse the hook with the book and get the author totally off course, and they basically wasted their time for being there. One other thing I want to go back to is the role that media plays in success of an author. Is like, for instance, right now, Radio Susie has like going on 8,000 people that follow her on Twitter. I've got like 17,000 something, something, something. So between the two of us, there's 24,000 people who follow on Twitter. While you and I are doing this interview, she is on both Twitter sites saying, "We're interviewing you right now." It's going out to 24,000 people who go out to I don't know how many more thousands of people based on their lists. So going into the media is a very powerful way to do it.
Yes, absolutely. And social media has definitely added a new component to the opportunity to reach audiences with them with the message or story or information that an author has to offer.
Yeah, and then every time when I mess up something and she's sitting on the other end of the desk here and she throws something at me, I immediately get on Twitter and say she's after me. And they all know. Now, let me ask you one thing. Most people, they talk about book signings. And I've known many authors over a period of time that they go from city to city to city. Is the book signing really a good idea?
Honestly, I tell authors, unless you are a well-known, nationally recognized name, doing book signings outside of your own local community or at least somewhere where you could travel within, say, 30 minutes to an hour is really a waste of your time and your money. Because unless you're known to where there's going to be, you know, potentially hundreds and hundreds of people that come to that book signing because of your recognition, you know, Nancy Pelosi goes and does a book signing, then perhaps a whole lot of people are going to set the building on fire. I mean, go and try to see her to have her sign their book, but unless you have some type of national recognition, it's going to be really difficult to have to actually see a monetary return on investment from a book signing. But if you're in your local area, absolutely. Do a book signing. Most of your independent stores will allow you to do one. But if you're going to, don't bother traveling anywhere that will create an expense. Like, oh, I'm going to go to Dallas and do a book signing. You're still only probably going to have 10 to 15, maybe 30 at the most book sales. And you're going to be selling them to the bookstore at 40% off the retail price, so you're not going to make very much money at all from the event. Now, you might connect with somebody there that ends up being to bring you in as a speaker or something like that, but as far as actually creating any kind of significant revenue from a book signing, it's just not going to happen. I would rather see an author put that same effort and energy into trying to do a reading in front of an audience like at a that's sponsored by a school or sponsored by an association or some type of specialty group or church group or, you know, community group or something like that where you can have the potential to sell, you know, 50, 100 books.
Yeah, so you got people with a common interest.
Right, exactly. And I mean, now one of the things you can do with book signings that's fun is if you're already going to be traveling to another city to see a relative or something like that, while you're there, go ahead and book a book signing because you know, there's two things that'll allow you to write off some of your expenses. Obviously, you should get consult your accountant on that type of strategy. But that's a typical strategy that can be used, a portion of at least your expenses would be deductible because you're doing some business while you're on that trip. And then also you might be able to make some connections, especially if you're a motivational author or an educational author or historical author. You have opportunities to earn income as a speaker, but even as a writer of fiction, if you can speak on the themes present in your work of fiction, or you can speak on writing or developing characters or some type of where you could actually speak and then get paid for that speaking, then it might be worthwhile to make some connections in that community using the book signing as a tool. But you're not trying to actually make money for a book signing. You're trying to create connections with a book signing.
Yeah, Todd, one more thing, which I think is something to look at. I remember, I'm going to go back, 25, 26 years ago, working in a small radio station in a small town. And everybody knew each other. And in the old days, what you did is you walked into business after business. You just walked in and you talked to the owner, etc. And I remember there was a time I was sitting at my desk and one of the guys walked in. I was a sales manager. And one of the guys walked in and he said, you know, every business I walked into today to talk to, you'd call them 5 minutes before. So effectively, I used the telephone when everybody was out there driving around because I was still responsible to bring some income in. That said, let's work to the virtual book tours, because the virtual book tour is a lot better than going from city to city to city.
Exactly. See, I'm all about the concept of the virtual book tour and other forms like radio interviews, television interviews, no good, unless it's nationally syndicated, because you're traveling once again to get very little exposure. But I'll do a virtual book tour, which is really basically when a website, typically a blog, agrees to feature your book or agrees to feature an interview with you or an article with you. So you might be able to get, you know, for instance, I currently have a database of 71 different book bloggers that have agreed to do virtual book tours for authors. So literally, depending on a person's budget, we could get, you know, each of these bloggers, we get 10 bloggers, we get 20 bloggers, and these bloggers, some of them have thousands of followers. So rather than you can do it all from your home, and in most cases via email. You just send a copy of your book in either PDF form or printed form to the blogger. They send you perhaps a questionnaire with an interview questions or common things that they like to ask of an author. And then they'll feature you on their blog, and their 500, 300, 1,000, 2,500 different followers of their blog are going to be exposed to your book. And so, in essence, you can even, some of them can even, there's the capability of doing live chats where you're on, you tell everybody, okay, my book's going to be featured on this blog. And and the blogger lets all their people that they know, their Twitter followers, their fan page friends, they let everybody know that they're going to be on Twitter, and that this particular blog post about their book and the interview is going up at X, and then they're going to be answering questions. And so, definitely anything that can be done without having to travel or create a significant amount of expense is just tremendous. Opportunity and technology to create exposure for your book today on a very, very small budget.
And that's that T-shirt I just bought, and I'm going to take advantage of everything that it says. Make money while you're sleeping.
I like that.
Todd Rutherford, we're about out of time. Website we can find you at?
AskThePublishingGuru.com. Every way to connect with me is available on that website. More than 300 articles on writing, publishing, and marketing books, and I'm also available for free initial consultations with anybody who needs help.
And the contact information is on the website?
Yes, sir. AskThePublishingGuru.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Todd, see you next week.
All right, sir. Bye-bye.
Take care. Good night.
Where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful.
If you miss a website for any of our guests, go to the website, www.dresserafterdark.com. They'll be there for a long time. There are so many
simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Bill Lussi with us. He is a certified financial planner. He is the author of Retire in a Weekend, The Baby Boomer's Guide to Making Work Optimal, Do What You Want, When You Want, Where You Want. Again, he's America's retirement strategist. He's a highly sought-after advisor, retirement authority, thought leader, author, and a national TV personality. Because he makes the complicated and mundane topics of investing in retirement, here goes that word, fun. Bill's got over 20 years' experience in the financial services industry, and again, he's a certified financial planner, practitioner, and a certified senior advisor, and a certified retirement coach. And let us say, Bill, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
It is Losey, the opposite of Hi-C.
I got it. Losey. Well, the fun started. This is good. By the way, retirement, it's changed so much. And I'm sure in the 20 years that you've been in the business, retirement takes a completely different look today than it did 20 years ago. So can we really define what retirement means to a person?
Well, you actually hit the nail on the head. Everybody actually has their own definition of what retirement is. So for me, it's really about making work optional. So for, you know, those individuals that are, you know, financially and mentally prepared, it might mean one thing where that means they can really walk away from their full-time job and they can live off of their financial resources for the rest of their life and never have to generate an income anymore. But for a lot of folks, I mean, you know, and we've seen lots of different studies come out, and, you know, just this year, you know, I mean, basically every year, that talks about how, you know, a lot of pensions are underfunded and, you know, the average 401k balance is $25,000. So a lot of people haven't been doing a good job of saving. So for a lot of those folks, it's like when I talk about making work optional, I really talk about, you know, finding a career or a job or a company, you know, or some sort of pursuit that you are passionate about, so that work becomes play and play equals work, and then that way you can continue, you know, being active and generating income for quite some time, and perhaps not retiring in the traditional sense, but in essence you have made work optional.
You know, well, you mentioned financially able to do it, but you mentioned another word that I think is a word that most people do not address, and the word was mentally ready, and there are too many people who aren't mentally ready. Remember the movie Jack Nicholson about Schmidt? Did you see it? Yeah.
I did.
He retired, and all of a sudden he was lost. And once he got out there,
I was going to say, I mean, one of the biggest retirement mistakes that I see, you know, for individuals over age 50 is that they retire when what they really need and want is just a break. You know, I did research, you know, back in the spring and summer of 2007. We surveyed more than 5,000 individuals, baby boomers, who subscribed to my newsletter, Retirement Intelligence. And, you know, we basically, you know, wanted to find out, you know, what their biggest concerns were, what kind of questions they had on their mind. You know, and a real interesting thing happened. We were able to nail down the five concerns. We were able to nail down, you know, the 10 biggest questions. But we also came across the mistakes. And this is the big one that I see. You know, you get a lot of people who are just tired and burnt from having to wake up to the alarm clock every Monday morning at 6 o'clock. You know, and a lot of folks that are in their mid-50s, you know, have been working since their, you know, teen years. So they've been working for four decades. And these people just really want to have a respite, and they really want to be able to control their own time. So what I always tell folks is that, you know, prior to, you know, considering retirement, you know, in full, you know, maybe you want to go from, you know, full-time employment, you know, down to a phased retirement where now you can work just 4 days per week or 3 days per week. Because for a lot of people, I mean, just that extra day or two off per week is all the rest and respite that they need. And in fact, for a lot of folks, it actually invigorates them, and they actually want to continue to work longer, although on a part-time phased, basis.
Yeah. Now, by the way, Bill, there's something that you said went by way too fast. All right. And before I mention what this is, most people, and if I have to repeat this every night, five times a night, I think it's critically important. Most people need somebody with the expertise that they do not have to look over their shoulder and guide them to what they do not see. i.e. bring the invisible up to the table. You mentioned the word retirement intelligence. There was a newsletter. So let's go back over that because I think that's critical. There's so many people who we take for granted. We know what we're going to do. We know how it's going to be. That's not so. But if you deal with, and I love the title, retirement intelligence, that's taking a look at it from a practical standpoint and realize what you're getting into before you get into it. So let's go back over the newsletter. First, how do we get the newsletter and what's in the newsletter?
Well, people can get the newsletter. It's a free weekly email newsletter. It comes out every Thursday morning, sometime between 9 a.m. and 12 Eastern time, because I know we've got listeners all across the country. People can get it by going to www.myretirementsuccess.com. That's myretirementsuccess.com. And all they have to do is plug in their email address and hit enter, and they'll get an email confirmation, and then next Thursday it'll show up in their email box. I've been publishing Retirement Intelligence now for 6 years, and when I first started, it was a once-per-month paper newsletter that went out only to my existing clients. And in September of 2006, I decided I was going to go online, I was going to publish this thing, I was going to go nationwide and see what happens. And, and I'm happy to say we've got about 7,000 subscribers now all over the country. But it's a different newsletter. Although it has the title of Retirement Intelligence, I mean, because I'm a retirement coach as well as a senior advisor and certified financial planner, I understand that it's not just about money. It's really about more what the money can do for you and how you want to live your life. So it's really a very sort of holistic newsletter where each issue is dedicated to enhancing a person's health, wealth, and happiness. So there's always some sort of a feature article or a feature video, that I do that has something to do with personal finance, more specifically towards retirement, and it's definitely directed to individuals, in their 50s and 60s, although younger people in their 40s, 30s, and 20s certainly, would be able to benefit from it. But then we have a health and happiness section where I have information in there from, other colleagues around the country who are in different fields. So, for example, I might have a dietitian who's writing an article about, proper, a food intake or dieting or how to lose weight. Or I might have a personal trainer talking about exercise, or I might have a sex therapist talking about, how to keep the magic in your relationship. And then, of course, because I like to have fun and have a good time, there's always got to be a joke of the week in there as well. So it's really different because it's not just some dry, old, boring personal finance newsletter.
Yeah, because retirement is just not, and I'm going to go back to the word mentally again, the retirement is just not physically stopping the career, the job, whatever it was you had, and moving on. There's so much more, and if you are not prepared for it, it's almost a different culture, isn't it?
Well, it's a huge culture. I mean, and the way that I always tell people is, like, think about this. I mean, if you have a full-time job, and let's just say, you've been working, since you've been in your 20s, and maybe now you're in your early 60s. You've been working for 4 decades. So every day you wake up and you go and you commute and you do your thing, right? Well, when all of a sudden you're not working 40 hours per week and you didn't have the commute, what does that do? All of a sudden you've got 50, 60, maybe 70 hours of free time per week. The question is, how do you fill that time? And a lot of people say, oh, well, I'm going to go golf. Well, I had one client years ago that said he was going to golf, and I was like, well, how often do you golf now? And he goes, one day a week. And I said, well, when you retire, how much are you going to golf? He goes, one day a week. I said, that's great, but what about the other 6 days? What are you going to do? Because the research is so critical, and it's so alarming. There are so many people who don't have some sort of pursuit or passion, and when they walk away from their job, they actually start to deteriorate both mentally and physically, and they end up not living, and they end up dying. So that's not to say that you can't retire, but the bottom line is when you retire, you still need to have some sort of activity and schedule and regularity in order to keep your body and your mind mentally engaged, because if you don't, you are just going to wither away.
No question about it. And I really believe it's almost like a retire. Here's something for you. Try this one out. Start a completely new segment of it. It's called Retirement Boot Camp.
Yeah, we've actually done a couple of those, only we call them retire in a weekend boot camps.
Okay, that's really what it is when we're really dealing with it. And it's like any kind of education. You have to learn about something. There's the difference between going to school. Going to school, you get educated. When you leave school, then you start to apply the wisdom that you've learned based on the education that you've used. And I really believe we can learn about retirement, but there's a wisdom that goes with it, because if you get out there and you're not expecting what can happen, it can cause a lot of problems within the family.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's what I always tell people. I mean, I have a very small nationwide client base of individuals that I work with and help and strategize with and consult and manage investment portfolios for. But that research that I gathered back in 2007 was absolutely priceless, because, I mean, I had 5,000 baby boomers tell me what their biggest concerns and questions were, and I got feedback from them that I used in my book. So it's not just, you know, me and my experience over 20 years, with my small client base. It's the experience of over 5,000 baby boomers nationwide. You know, and you just, I mean, it's kind of hard to beat.
Sure. Well, what you're saying is basically it's 5,000 people in a focus group.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I got it loud and clear. Let me ask you this. There is a point that you speak about, and it's called why building wealth, not reducing debt, should be your ultimate goal. There's too many people out there not building wealth. They're reducing debt. They're being careful what they spend, and it's not going into the right place.
Well, here's the scoop. When you pay off debt, in essence, you're increasing your net worth. You are building wealth. But when people focus on getting out of debt and paying off the credit cards, those items have a negative connotation, and people do not like things that are negative. When you talk about building wealth, I mean, it's a positive thing. You're talking about the potential. There's hope for people. So even though paying off credit card debt will actually help you build your net worth, I like to focus on just building wealth instead, because it's positive and people tend to actually stick with it better than just trying to reduce a credit card.
Now, by the way, in this very uncalculatable world that we live in with the economy the way it is, how safe is it to put things into retirement today? And when I say how safe is it, are there structures, are there strategies that you can use today that nothing's really ever guaranteed, but at least there's a good feeling that it will be there when you need it, because what we may need today to live may not work in 10, 15 years from now when the prices of everything go up.
Yeah, well, see, you actually hit the nail on the head, and that is actually one of the things and areas that we actually talk about in Retire in a Weekend. We actually talk about assumptions and guarantees. Because if you think about it for a moment, I mean, nobody really has any idea what return they're going to earn on their money. They really have no idea what inflation is going to be in the future. We have no idea what tax rates are going to be in the future. We have no idea if we're going to be downsized or let go by our employer. You know, we don't know if we're going to get attacked again. I mean, we really don't know a darn thing. So what I always tell people is that, I mean, all financial planning and investment decisions are based on assumptions. And the more that people resist this fact, the more susceptible they are to disappointment and failure. Because there aren't many things that we can control. So, I mean, I have people focus on what we can control, like saving money, like watching their expenses, like paying off their debt, like not going out and buying that really expensive car when with something else that's more reliable with four wheels and better gas mileage will do the exact same trick. So that's where the actual coaching comes in. But you know, there are some general guidelines and some general rules, but this is where, I mean, I think it's really important that, you know, that people do work with some sort of a financial advisor or a coach to really help them through, you know, again, using their past experience, because the bottom line is we're emotional beings. I mean, and it really came, to a head, if you think about it, back in late 2008 and early 2009 during the financial crisis. We had the same thing back in 2002, you know, right after, 9/11. I mean, you know, people tend to move in herds, and when people panic, they all sell, you know, the stocks, for example, and then when things look better, they all start to buy again. You actually want to try to go against the herd, and that's really, really hard for an individual to do on their own. So that's where the help and advice of a trusted coach can actually come in to really keep them on track and just remind them that their plan is sound and solid, and that these types of unforeseen events were planned for and anticipated.
Sure, and it's called buy it when it's down, because when it goes up, everybody's after it, and your profit margin isn't as great. And there are experts like yourself who know certain businesses, certain industries, no matter what happens to the economy, it's going to be cyclical, but they will still maintain a solid base and see their way through. Now, Bill Losee, let me ask you this. Is there a website, again, that we can find you at? We're starting to run out of time.
Yeah, I mean, people, again, can go right back to myretirementsuccess.com. That's the website I mentioned earlier. People can go there and can sign up, you know, with their email address and can download some free gifts as well as, you know, the free lifetime subscription to Retirement Intelligence, the newsletter. And for those folks that, you know, don't want to give out their email address, that's fine, too. And, you know, down in the bottom right corner, there's an Enter Website button that'll pull them right back to the site. And they'll see more free resources there, and they can get comfortable with me before they decide to, you know, give up their name.
Wonderful. Hey, Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Bye now.
We'll warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to Dresser After Dark. Stay up, stay tuned, stay with us. Wait till you hear what's coming up next.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to Dresser After Dark. Our guest, James Greenblatt, MD, Dr. James Greenblatt. He's a duly certified child and adult psychiatrist. He's a pioneer in integrative medicine. He's lectured throughout the United States and Canada on the scientific evidence for nutritional and other interventions for mental illness. He's a medical director of eating disorder services at Walden Behavioral Care, a psychiatric facility in Waltham, Massachusetts, and founder and medical director of Comprehensive Psychiatric Resources, a private integrative psychiatric practice near Boston. And he's received his medical degree and completed his psychiatry residency at George Washington University and a fellowship of child and adolescent psychiatry at Johns Hopkins Medical School. And let us say, James, hi, welcome to the show.
Great. It's great to be here, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I've listened, and I'm not a clinician, and I've listened to a lot of people talk about depression for years, but you've got a completely different way of handling this. And for what I'm looking at, I have the book in front of me, by the way, and it is totally a keeper. What I'm looking at, it's what you eat will cause the way you feel, good or bad.
Absolutely. The brain is our most metabolically active organ in the body. Excuse me. So any kind of deficiency is going to affect brain function, mood and behavior before physical manifestations.
Now, by the way, when we eat normally, we're not really getting the nutrients out of foods that we can get. By the time they're shipped to us, they're diluted. By the time we eat them, they're diluted. Supplementation, how critical is that for depression?
Well, we're finding more and more that, as you described, the food is devoid of these essential nutrients, particularly minerals. And since the brain requires these minerals, we begin to see mood, emotional, and behavior problems with these nutritional deficiencies. So food is the key, and nutrient-dense food is obviously much better, but many times people need nutritional supplements to augment what they eat to feel better.
You know, one of the things, and I think it's an interesting comment, I've got your press release in front of me, and one of the things that you've talked about, which I think is something to make you step back and really take a look. The number one cause of disability in the United States, the cost of depression is hardly trivial. Over the next 20 years, depression is projected to become the number one cause of disability in high-income countries like the U.S. and the number two cause of disability worldwide. High-income countries. because of the intelligence that goes along with the high income, will that cause depression based on the economy?
Well, I think more likely is what's happening to these economies is the high intake of processed, nutrient-devoid foods. So, you know, we see it all the time when people from other cultures start adopting the American diet. They have more incidence of medical health problems, including diabetes, and we also believe mental health problems, including depression.
Now, by the way, the one of the things to back that up, I think, was Japan. Years ago, their staple was fish, and then they had a tremendous amount of nutrition from it. Somehow, McDonald's got there, and then all of a sudden, they've got heart problems and every other disease that you can possibly think of because of the processed foods. I go back a lot of years, and I remember eating a hamburger in the 50s. It tasted like a hamburger. It tasted like meat. Today, I can't eat one because I've taken a bite out of a hamburger at any local restaurant, and they taste different. There's something that's missing, and I think that it's got to do with all the processing and everything that the cattle go through before they hit the dinner table.
Absolutely. There's a tremendous difference between, you know, what's called grass-fed beef, animals that range on grass, and the omega-3 content, which is the fatty acids, are closer to what would be in fish than the beef that most of us are eating on a regular basis.
Now, for the average person, and let's say the average person, I mean, the average person could be anybody from a CEO, CFO at a major corporation, 500 rated company, or the person on the street or the homemaker at home. The food that they eat, obviously, as you're saying, controls what it is. But how do we know what they're lacking? You know, are there tests for something like this? Just to say to somebody, have amino acids and have a supplement that's got this and that in it, may not necessarily be good for them, because there's not a one-size-fits-all program when we're dealing with nutrition.
Absolutely. And that's the premise of this book. It's personalized medicine. It's kind of a nine-step kind of guide as how to look and see if there are physical causes to your depression. So there's hormone tests, there's metabolic testing, there's other blood tests where we can determine if there are nutritional deficiencies that may be playing a role in the depression that you've been struggling with. And it's not the same vitamin that for everyone, just like it's not the same medication for everyone. So we have a program that looks at individualized medications as well as individualized nutritional programs.
So we're really dealing with something that could, let's say, replace medication if it's not that severe, or preventative to get, so you don't have to get to that point where you've got to take particular medicine. I know kids today that take, you know, Wellbutrin and medicine like that. The minute that they stop taking it, they're very hard to be around, very hard to deal with. So can we exchange nutrition for these chemical medicines?
I believe for many, many patients that we're able to uncover nutritional deficiencies that are contributing factors to the depression. A B12 deficiency, a food allergy, a hormonal deficiency, a sleep problem, sleep apnea. Other times, medications might be necessary, but the tremendous side effects prohibit people from taking it. There's sexual side effects, GI, chronic stomach problems, as well as other side effects that get in the way of them taking the medications. So what we're able to do is looking at individualizing medications based on unique testing, as well as individualizing the supplements.
Okay, so effectively, if we come into the doctor's office, we get certain blood tests. Those blood tests are going to tell us if we're high or low with any particular hormone, nutrient, whatever the case may be. And based on what's high or low, then the prescription would be different foods that are maybe high in one substance, or stay away from something else that's particular high. You might have an overdose of one particular too much vitamin A, too much calcium, too much something, which can cause a problem. So in essence, the test will tell you what to stay away from and what more to eat to get you balanced out. Am I close here?
Yes, absolutely. Everybody is different, just the way we look and the way we our eye and fingerprint, and looking at one's individual metabolism can help us determine if something is contributing to your depression. Absolutely.
Now, I know one thing you also address in the book on page 98. How's that? I memorized the whole thing. It's correcting the thyroid levels to relieve depression. Who would think, if you're not a clinician, that the thyroid could cause depression?
Well, it is a very common cause of depression. And there are a number of symptoms of hypothyroidism that your primary care doctor might think about. If you're chronically fatigued, if you're gaining weight, if you have high cholesterol, if you're constipated, and if you're depressed. But if you don't have that collection of all those symptoms, people aren't going to think hypothyroidism. Many times the presentation is simply depression. So it's a simple blood test that needs to be looked at that can help a lot of people struggling with depression.
You know, we've heard for years, you know, women, the female hormones and mood, and there's the problem there, which is open. But there's also the same thing in men with a lack of testosterone. And what happens is you grow older, you start producing less and less. And if you don't know that, you can't fix the problem. So in essence, that low testosterone could also cause depression from what I'm hearing here and seeing.
Yes, and we might think about it in a 60 or 70-year-old man. We're finding in 30 and 40-year-old men, due to a lot of, environmental pollutants as well as nutritional deficiencies that are causing testosterone deficiency, that are causing depression. And you walk into a psychiatrist's office, they're not going to look at hormone levels, and they're certainly not going to look at testosterone levels, but it could be the cause of a significant depression for a male, sometimes even females, and by repleting these hormones, the mood improves without any medications.
So effectively, when someone goes in to, let's say for counseling, they're depressed. Normally, from what I've seen happen over the years, you know, they go into counseling and then there's usually some kind of a medication to help balance it off. So what I'm hearing you say, that if you eat the proper foods, you get the proper nutrients, you can almost balance a lot of this out yourself.
Yes.
Okay.
The point of medications is just psychiatrists looking at a list of symptoms. Nobody is looking at the cause. There's no way we're going to be able to find the cure or find a biological cause if we don't look for it. And psychiatrists don't do tests. They just prescribe medications based on symptoms.
You know, by the way, in chapter 18, when you've got prayer and placebos, reminds me of a very quick story. Years ago, I had a very close friend of mine who had a doctorate in theology. And when he was working on his doctorate, he went to Spain and Portugal and those states, or those countries, I'm sorry. And what he found in those countries, the psychiatric beds compared to the rest of Europe were empty. They didn't have as many. Now and I happen to be Jewish, but those countries were predominantly Catholic. And what the Catholics have is their confession. And what had occurred when they went to confession, they dumped a lot of the things that they were holding on to, and they didn't get into the moods and the depression and the rest of it. Where the rest of Europe that was not predominantly Catholic did not have the confession to work with, had a lot of beds filled up in the psychiatric hospitals. And I really believe prayer would be basically the same thing as confession.
Yes, the last section of the book is called Nurturing the Mind. The first part is Nourishing the Brain. And we talk a lot about, there's a lot of research supporting just what you said, that the belief in a God, it doesn't matter what the configuration of that God is, it decreases depressed mood, and prayer has been helpful. And there are even studies on what you're describing, forgiveness, and I called it just letting go.
Sure.
Significant decreases in depression. So absolutely.
Because if you hold on to if you hold on to it, you're going to internalize it, and if you internalize it, that's going to play havoc with your entire system.
Yes.
Yeah, changes chemistry and everything else. And once we remembered, somebody once said to me that laughter is the best medicine. Well, actually, what happens when you laugh, your brain releases endorphins, makes you feel good, calms you down. And when you hear something that's good for you, or there's a fix to a problem that you might have had, the brain actually releases endorphins and you feel better. So smiling, when they say smile, it's one of the best medicines. It's beyond just smiling. It's the chemical, it's the triggering of the chemicals in the brain that cause you to calm down and feel better.
Yes, and I don't know if you got to it, but there's a section in the book on laughter. Absolutely right.
So realistically, when we come down to it, over the years, and especially in the last 5 or 10 years, neurosciences are really starting to, I'm going to say, take over, because we're learning more and more about the brain and the interaction of the brain and the chemicals that the brain releases to cause our moods and cause depression or non-depression, etc. It is so important today, and you said it, what we eat, how we think, what we do, what we externalize, and it all has to do with what that brain's going to release, because the brain will protect us. And when it protects us, it could protect us by creating something called depression when you can't take anymore. Interesting points.
I think that it's critical that the field of psychiatry and neuroscience, as you said, is exploding with research, but sometimes very simple, inexpensive interventions are overlooked, and that's what we're finding with nutritional interventions for mood disorders. There's good research to support a lot of nutrient interventions, but contemporary psychiatry really is overlooking these interventions and focusing on medications and research to support the high profits for the pharmaceutical industries.
Sure, because when we talk about allopathic medicine, we're talking basically chemicals. But medicine in and of itself was originally derived from plants. So we're really talking about getting back to basics here, the difference between conventional and I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember the word I want. But it's conventional and traditional is what I want. The difference between conventional and traditional medicine. And I think more and more we're finding more traditional medicine coming into that allopathic field, and more doctors are realizing that there's got to be a combination of both if you really want to get the maximum out of helping a patient.
Right, and we use the word integrative medicine. And I kind of label what I do as integrative psychiatry, where I prescribe prescriptions every day to patients struggling with depression, but I integrate that with looking at underlying nutritional causes. And we actually have found that nutrition and certain supplements can enhance the effect of medication. And these are research done from Harvard at the Harvard Medical School over the past couple of years. So we can augment the effect of medications with nutritional supplements.
Now, by the way, when we talk about the simple, I'm going to use the word cure in a very broad sense, but the simple cures, the idea of what's going on with nutrition, et cetera, today, which can cause a tremendous effect on a person's ability to be able to deal with their life, it's the dynamic that occurs behind it. The average person does not have to know what that dynamic is. They do not have to know about brain chemistry. They don't have to know about neurosciences. But at the same time, what the end result is, quote unquote, eat an apple, you'll feel better. Smile, you'll feel better. And they don't have to know the dynamic.
That's correct. A lot of individuals have spent many, many years in psychotherapy looking for causes rather than a simple blood test or trying to see if there's a hormonal imbalance.
Yeah, by the way, James, I really appreciate the time you spent with us. Is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes, it's just James Greenblatt, MD, is the website where we have this book and the first book on anorexia that we did.
Wonderful. Hey, James, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Doc on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Rich Hansen was with us. Rick Hansen is with us. He's a neuropsychologist and affiliate faculty of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. He's the author of the best-selling Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, published in 20 languages. He's the founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplated Wisdom. He's taught at Oxford, Stanford, Harvard, and in meditation centers in Europe, North America, and Australia. Rick, hi, welcome to the show.
Great to be back. Great to be here.
Oh, by the way, thank you for being here. You know, when I got the book originally, what happens is Radio Susie grabs the book. She does stuff. This one was a keeper.
Oh, good. I'm very glad about that.
Oh, yeah. No, I've got the book. Let's talk about neuroscience, the science of happiness, the science of love, the science of wisdom. And I just did a show early on with a psychiatrist who was dealing a lot with nutrition and getting rid of depression. And it's almost along the same lines, based on what you eat, based on your brain chemistry. It's going to determine how you feel.
Yeah, I think the takeaway point is that what happens in the brain really shapes how we experience life and how we act toward others. And then the practical question, because I'm a practical guy like you are and your previous guest, the question is how to influence that brain, right? And one way into it is, of course, through physical methods, ranging from good nutrition at one end of the spectrum to good medications, right, at the other end of the spectrum. Another approach, though, is to use your mind alone, to use what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity. I know that's a mouthful. It's the basic idea that how you think and where you put your attention and what you do with what's in your mind will actually structure your brain for the better over time.
Okay, so a thought will create a chemical reaction in the brain.
That's right. In other words, a physical and chemical reaction occurs in the brain that correlates with that thought, that represents it, if you will. What happens is, under certain conditions, a lasting trace will be left behind. for better and for worse. The problem is that the brain is biased toward the negative, because that's the sort of thing that kept our ancestors alive. You know, they had to eat lunch today instead of being lunch today. That was first and foremost back in the Serengeti. But the problem is that negativity bias, as one example, causes negative experiences to always leave an immediate trace, but positive experiences generally don't, unless they're a million-dollar moment. That's why doing different kinds of simple things at work or in traffic or raising kids or doing whatever it is you do, simple things like focusing on positive experiences can actually improve your brain over time.
Okay, but when we talk about this, I'm going to go back to protection, that obviously the fight or flight mechanism. You know, the mind itself triggers things. You got a conscious mind, and that's reason, logic, willpower, etc. And then you got that unconscious mind. When that conscious mind is overloaded to a point it can't deal with it, that analytical sense of evaluation, that let's call it a filtering system, breaks down. Things pour into that unconscious mind, and just as you were talking about before, that mechanism of survival triggers, and what'll cause it to calm down. There's two parts of that, three parts of the nervous system. You got the central nervous system, that's your conscious mind, but the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems that will allow you to compensate once you lose control. And it all has to do with, as you're talking about, chemicals that create these things. So we will protect each other protect ourselves no matter what happens, and most people aren't aware of that.
Yeah, I think a lot about what can people actually do. You know, I think so many of us feel pretty pushed around by big forces. You know, what does Congress do about the deficit, or what's Al-Qaeda doing, or what's the Saudi government doing about oil, or what's Big Pharma doing about the cost of ordinary medications and so on. And it's great, on the other hand, to feel that truly inside your own self, where you're kind of intimate with yourself, that you actually can do things that are simple, practical, down-to-earth. They're not airy-fairy. They're not new-agey, woo-woo sort of things. They're grounded in science, but they will actually change your brain for the better over time. I'll give you, if I could, three fast examples.
Please.
One is to really do what I just talked about, which is half a dozen times a day, when you have an opportunity to feel mildly good about anything, take the extra 15 to 30 seconds to really stay with that experience. That will, in the saying in neuroscience, cause neurons to fire together, so they will gradually wire together inside your own brain. Or I call it taking in the good. Just stay with something you're grateful for, or a recognition of some accomplishment that you've done, or some simple thing, or someone's been good to you, and so forth. That's the first thing. The second is, whenever you can and you have a chance to feel cared about, because we're such profoundly social animals, again, really take that extra 10, 20, 30 seconds to stay with the sense of feeling cared about. Because, you know, when we evolved, exile was a death sentence. So that, over time, will gradually improve resilience and actually make a person a more caring person themselves. So it's not selfish to do this. It's actually good for other people if you do this. And the third thing is, when you feel the needle of your stress meter, you know, moving out of green into yellow and then orange and red, do whatever you can to keep it out of the red zone. I mean, we evolved to handle short bursts of stress, but the long-term chronic stress that we're experiencing today is completely unprecedented in evolution, and is known to have, as you and other guests have pointed out, is known to have serious health consequences. And little things can help you bring that needle back, like multiple long exhalations. As you noted, the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system is very involved in helping us keep on an even keel, and it gets involved in exhaling. So if you just do 3 to 10 long exhalations, which you can do in the middle of a crazy business meeting or arguing with the in-laws or someone who knows what. Anyway, if you do that, that will bring the needle back down.
And by the way, or work out, you know, and it's...
Yeah, exercise is great too. Yeah, a lot of different ways. You know, the nice thing is that you really are going to be gradually changing your brain. And in my book, really, it's incredibly well referenced, because I'm paranoid about making mistakes. I don't want to make mistakes. So it's super grounded in science. And there are so many studies now that show how little practices, you know, little things, every day, though, little things can make a big difference in your brain over time.
And let's go back over what I was talking about a moment ago, because to back up what you were saying, you get the conscious mind, you get the unconscious mind. You get an overload in the conscious mind, it breaks down that filtering system, and that autonomic nervous system pops in with those two divisions of it. And when you're breathing, when you're doing what you just said, when you are breathing and taking in maybe 10 breaths, what you do is you put your conscious mind back in control again. And you're responding based on the way you want to respond, not the way that you would automatically respond to protect yourself. With that fight or flight mechanism, with that primitive response that we have, three things can happen. You run away, you stand up and fight, or you lay down and play dead until the danger's over with. And depression is laying down and playing dead. And as you said, those 10 breaths make all the difference in the world because they get that filtering system back in shape again.
That's really true. There's a long debate in science, philosophy, religion, and all the rest. You know, is human nature basically good or bad? And I think that, for me at least, the answer to that is that when people are not disturbed, in other words, if they're not hungry, they're not in pain, they're not worried about their pensions or their teenagers or what have you, then the brain normally defaults to a pretty good place. Basically, we evolved in terms of the kind of reptile brain, the rat brain, and then the primate human brain. We basically evolved in terms of three systems, avoiding harm, number one, number two, approaching rewards, and then number three, attaching to us. So avoiding, approaching, and attaching. And what the brain does when we're not threatened is it defaults to a good place in terms of each of those three systems that I call calm, contented, and caring. In other words, the avoiding system defaults to a basic state of calm, characterized, as you said, by a lot of parasympathetic activation. The approaching system defaults to a state of contentment. People are typically mildly happy. There's mild well-being, but very pervading and pleasant well-being. And then last, when they feel included, they don't feel rejected or treated in mean ways and so forth, they default to a place of caring. So we have calm, contented, and caring. That's the good news. That's great. It's great to know that the resting state, the home base of the brain, if you will, is good. The problem is Mother Nature also evolved hair trigger mechanisms that will drive us from that home base at the crackle of a twig in the brush nearby, or these days, a frown across the dinner table. And the same machinery that evolved to keep us alive when chased by tigers or lions, but now activates the day when we're caught up in a quarrel with someone, that we live with or work with. And then we tip into this very reactive mode. To me, a lot of the practice is to gradually, come home again. In other words, to gradually increase the number of moments a person has in that more responsive mode of the brain, its natural resting state, its home base. And because neurons that fire together wire together, the more time you clock in that natural state, the deeper the grooves of it, as it were, you dig inside your own brain in a good way. So it becomes increasingly like having a deep keel in the water. It becomes increasingly where you're centered, no matter how the winds of life blow.
Oh, absolutely. And I really believe when it comes down to it, it's something called recognition. The mirror neurons, those empathic neurons in the emotional part of the brain, in the limbic system, they fire up when we see or we hear something that we recognize, and then we emotionally end up mirroring, imitating that action in our own mind. You said something about the look across the dinner table, the somatic marker. It's an emotional bookmark. It's like a tag. What it does, it connects your experiences to very specific emotions that you recognize. And then obviously what it is, it's an unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association or an experience triggers a reaction. Prime example of this, I was 8 years old, and I use the example all the time, but I was 8 years old. I'm standing in front of the mirror. I'm playing cowboys. I got my hat on, cap gun, screaming and yelling. And my dad walked in, and he laughed at me, and he shut me right off. Now, as an 8-year old, I played again in front of the mirror, but I never did it again out loud. As an adult, I understand it. But as a teenager, you didn't dare laugh at me, and you didn't talk down to me. Unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association or an experience that triggers a reaction. If you were aware of it, it's fine. It wasn't the kid that was laughing at me. It was that triggering memory of my dad laughing at me, and I was responding to it. And I think that happens in relationships today.
Oh, I see clients routinely who, they're successful, they're, and so forth, they're midlife, and they go, boy,
I feel like such an idiot. I'm still getting upset about these things from when I was young. But guess what? The brain is a learning organ. It learns, and it especially learns from childhood, especially, you know, the first 3 to 10 years of childhood. And so it's completely natural to learn, right? That's why I think it's so important. For me, I'm a very stubborn, independent person, and people don't like being controlled. Well, guess what? You know, where do you think the main puppet strings are located that are pulling on you every day? It's inside your own head, right? It's inside the 3 pounds of tofu in the coconut, as it were. And so getting more control over those strings so you're in charge of your own life, to me, that's a wonderful thing.
Now, by the way, what I'm hearing you say is the control doesn't come externally. The control comes internally, and you're blaming it on somebody else.
Often, I think it's okay to appreciate the degree to which we're influenced by our environments, to be sure. But guess what? We don't have much influence over our environments, you know, or even our own bodies. But boy, do we have a heck of a lot of influence over our own brains. And just to use an example that you brought up previously, we're very sensitized, pardon me, by evolution to feel threatened. You know, I think about the last 10 years in America and, you know, the sense of threat, and I think about the ways in which just in everyday life people feel uneasy around each other or put off or threatened, like you talked about, you know, someone who might, you know, might laugh at you in a loving way, but yet that could feel threatening, you know, particularly until you were more self-aware, as it were. So
sure.
There we are feeling threatened. We're so prone to what I call paper tiger paranoia. And one of the things I tried to write about are a number of ways to feel as safe as you can reasonably feel. In other words, there's a place for appropriate anxiety. Yes, there are real tigers out there, for sure. But
sure.
If we walk around as people normally do, overestimating threats, underestimating opportunities, and underestimating resources, then we feel bad, we feel more stressed, and we act in ways that create threats for other people needlessly, and we play small, you know, because we're all hunkered down with this sense of living in life, threat level orange all the time, even though really, truly, most of life for most people is threat level chartreuse. You know, it's green with a pin drop of yellow.
Sure. Yeah, and we're waiting for it. And why are we waiting for it? We've learned to wait for it. And what I love about, by the way, your book is one of my favorites. I've had it for as long as
you read a lot, too, so I appreciate that.
and the key is it hits home. And you don't have to be aware of all of this, but you have to be aware that there is a dynamic that occurs that causes response and reactions. And that's critical. And I think if you take major marketing, they use neuroimaging to cause people to react and respond and to buy something. The buying response is a millisecond. It's a rush of dopamine, and that's the end of it. It's an emotional buy, and they know it. Most people don't know it, and it's all the way from why you buy something to emotional upset. So one of the things that I can see, if somebody really got into the book and understood it, that this is the path to emotional recovery for a lot of people.
I totally think so. You're exactly right. And it's, you know, what I myself really love about this material is that it's grounded in science, and it really is grounded in your own brain, you know. You really are taking greater control of it, which for me is just a really important thing, you know, in terms of making this world a better, safer place. When I think about people in everyday life, you know, dealing with, for example, the sense of stress in their own body, or getting triggered around their childhood, or, you know, getting reactive about other people, it's great to feel that increasingly you can have kind of shock absorbers, you know, inside your own mind, so that things still happen and you're not all la-di-da looking at the world through rose-colored glasses, but they don't yank your chain like they used to. And then when you do respond, you can do so from a more mindful, calmer, clearer, and actually stronger place.
You know, I got something out of the word mindful. There was a movie that I saw some years back. Did you see the movie The Peaceful Warrior?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I'm friends with Dan Millman, the writer of the book. Yeah, I know him.
Yeah, Millman was on last night.
Oh, interesting. Oh, perfect. Yeah.
And what happened, I mentioned this to him last night. There was something that happened in the movie. And what happened was what time is it now? Where are you here? What are you this moment in time? That hit me very hard when I first saw the movie. And I watched it probably 7-8 times after that. But that in and of itself, then I put a 5x7 card up in front of the, it was on the stand every time I did a show, which said that, and it said the show was about the show. What came from that, which was very interesting, was a technique. And I started to think about this and used it. Are you sitting at a desk?
Actually, I'm just standing right next to my desk, looking out through a window.
Okay, touch the desk just for a moment.
Okay.
Okay, now the desk just came into existence. For that moment, you were mindful. Before that, the desk wasn't even there. And I really believe when somebody needs to be mindful, they have to be aware of what's around them, not just 10 minutes ahead and 15 minutes behind. And that's where, for me, that gift that I got from him through the movie was the ability to practically know how to be mindful. And if I find myself getting stressed, I'll touch my chest. That allows me to be mindful. That's the 10 deep breaths. Whichever way you do it, it becomes intentional and mindful. And that's where the key is.
Yeah. I would say a small point and a big one. You know, the part about the breath point I was making is it's really about exhaling. In other words, if a person quietly does 3 to 5, maybe even 10 long exhalations, what that really does is that it activates the parasympathetic nervous system in a real striking way, in a way that's different from just the usual, you know, 10 big breaths. But the larger point, you know, I want to make here, if I could, is that it's really interesting to observe the fact that in the brain, there's this whole section that's sort of in the middle of the brain, as it were, midline area. It's called the default network. And what it does, I think of it as like a simulator, you know, like in Star Trek or something. It continually is creating little mini movies about the past or the future. Pardon me. And in which there's often a kind of negative theme of anger or fear or complaint. And there's a sense that there's the self, you know, as this kind of protagonist of this movie. So in the simulator, either, you know, grumbling about the future or past or fantasizing about some wonderful reward we're going to get, right? Just as you say, we're not touching the desk, you know? We're not here now. And when we're in that simulator, we're either caught up in, we're enchanted. You know, it's like a kind of subtle enchantment. People can be aware of it just in ordinary ways. You watch what happens when your mind is kind of wandering. And you realize that the fears that are embedded in that little mini movie are exaggerated. And the rewards that are embedded in that little mini movie are also exaggerated because they're linked to reward centers in the brain that are ancient and very primitive. But when we wake up from the enchantment to come to the present, you know, touching the desk, if you will, or coming to our senses, as it were, when we do that, then we step out of the simulator, and we're not being enchanted. We're not being hypnotized or tranced, if you will, by exaggerated threats or exaggerated opportunities. And if people notice it, they'll notice that they're all right now most of the time. Sometimes you're actually not all right now. Okay, that's for real. But most of the time, most people are actually all right now. And that itself is a beautiful practice, to just notice that you're actually all right now.
Yeah. Now, by the way, we're starting to run out of time, but one quick story, and I'll make it real fast. There was a time probably 20 years ago, I had horses for years, and there was a time about 20 years ago, I got a particular horse that when I went to saddle him, he'd go rear up, go over, and down. And he scared me, and I could not get rid of the fear. So I went over to the trainer, which lived about maybe a half mile away from me. I'd ride the horse over there, and we'd go into something called a round pen. I would be in the middle. The horse would be on a rope, and I would chase the horse with a crop. And she would get me so tired that I wasn't afraid anymore. And what happened was it changed the chemistry. So physical exercise can also do that. The exercise you talked about, the exhale, I've had doctors on to say if you feel a heart attack coming on, lay down and do 10 very deep breaths.
Interesting.
Yeah. We're just
you had a really smart trainer. That's a great story. Thank you.
Oh, she was brilliant. Yeah. Okay. Now, is there a website we can find you at?
Oh, buddhasbrain.com. We'll take you to my website. Thank you for asking me. It's chock full of free resources. The book itself is $12 on Amazon. I mean, that's a good price. But beyond that, on my website itself, I have all kinds of talks, interviews, slide sets from workshops I've given, many articles, as well as links to many other things. And don't be put off by the word brain or Buddha. You don't have to have any kind of scientific background to appreciate the practical tools. And, you know, while I have, really enormous respect for the Buddha as a fantastic teacher, both my website and also the book itself are not explicitly Buddhist. Anyone from any orientation or none at all, you know, to me, can relate to the bottom line pragmatic teachings and methods grounded in science currently for everyday happiness, love, and wisdom.
Absolutely. Hey, Rick Hansen, you're always welcome on the show.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It was a pleasure. I'm glad this turned out, you know, very on short notice, and I'm very glad about it.
Great, and good night.
Thank you very much.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
All my good wishes go with you tonight.
Brian Dooley with us. He's a CPA and MBT. He is the author of International Taxation in America, and he's an international tax specialist who regularly advises professionals and multinational families on how to manage cross-border tax issues and laws. He's the founder of the International Tax Counselors and has served as an expert witness on the Committee on Ways and Means for the House of Representatives, the Department of the Treasury, and the IRS. Brian, hi, welcome to the show. Well, I hope Brian's there. Brian, did we lose you? I guess we don't have Brian. Okay. Well, all right. We're going to talk about this for a moment. One of the most important things is understanding a multinational family, and there should be certain things that they have in place, because we are talking about a tax law today that I don't think there's anybody on the planet that could lift it. And really, the understanding of it, you've got to really be able to delve inside to catch it. And if you go from, and if you know anything about the IRS, every department in that IRS is individual. They specialize in a certain phase of taxes. And if you go to one department, they're not going to know. So it's got to go from department to department to department. And then based on political views, based on the society at the time, taxation is constantly changing. And when we're dealing with international taxation, added to what the changes are here constantly, well, we are looking at something that can confuse most people. And if we can get Brian on the air, then we'll find out, because the world, you know, and it's true, is shrinking and is getting smaller and smaller all the time. And it's a business. And the internet is really made going global much easier today. 50 years ago, you wouldn't think about this. But today, you could be dealing with somebody who's got a laptop sitting on their desk somewhere thousands and thousands of miles away in a country that you've never heard of. And they could probably speak English. And if they do, then you've got some kind of a common bond. Hey, Brian Dooley, I've introduced you. How are you? And thank you for being on the show.
I am fine. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm doing great. As a matter of fact, I think this is a subject that really people have to take a look at. But just saying, you know, 50 years ago, we didn't have international taxes basically for the average person. But we've shrunk. We've got smaller. We've got the internet. And today, you can be doing business with somebody who can be in a foreign country, and they're sitting at their desk with a computer, and that's how they do their business. And if you're getting an income, if you're making a profit, there's taxes, aren't there?
Well, that's right. And that really is how things have changed. We sell so many intangible items now, entertainment, music, knowledge, marketing, accounting, that these items can be done, as you say, on a laptop at any place in the world.
Now, by the way, when we talk about taxes, we're also talking about cross-border gifts inheritances that somebody may have, and it may come from a foreign country. They look at it differently. I guess, Brian, the question would be, if I were to get an inheritance from another country, would there be taxation on that country and then taxation on me for our tax code here? Would I get double taxed on it?
You can. And the United States is one of the few countries that have an estate tax. By that, it means that when you pass away, your heirs create an estate as a legal entity. They may go to court to decide how to transfer property, get a deed changed on real estate to the name of the spouse. And so our government taxes that estate. That estate is the party that owes the tax. In most other countries, it's an inheritance tax, which means that the people who receive the assets actually pay the tax. And in other countries, the tax rate depends upon the relationship. So in most nations, the spouse receives property and she pays no tax. If a child receives property, there's one tax rate. If it's a grandchild, there's a higher tax rate. And as you leave the family tree of the deceased, it's a higher tax rate. And what can happen is that you can pay tax twice, and you can actually pay tax a third time, because when you sell the property that you maybe is that's located in the foreign country, you may pay tax again as an income tax.
You know, there's also an interesting point here, too, that I know you discuss. We have a great percentage of people that are first generation and maybe second generation here. So you can be second generation or first generation and you can or second generation, and a gift can come from a grandparent from a foreign country. That has got to be dealt with. If there's X amount of dollars coming through, it's taxable, isn't it?
It is taxable. And then quite often the problem that parents have when their children receive assets is that they may be too young to really receive the assets. Sometimes they're a minor, and that gives the parent some control because the parent gets to control it. But often they're still 19 or 20, and the parents do not want the child to receive a lump amount because they think it's going to be misspent. And so the United States is unique in that it has what's called trust arrangements. And most people who have some wealth, especially in the West Coast, have what's called a living revocable trust. And trusts were started during the Great Crusade about 1,000 years ago. Because you can imagine, when you went to the Great Crusade, you were gone for a long time, and you may not come back. And at that time, the death tax was 100%. When you died 1,000 years ago, all your assets went to the king or the lord of the location where you were living. So people would form trust, and they would have a friend who they trusted to take charge of the assets. So only America and UK nations have trusts. So if you're living in France, if you want to leave money to your grandchild, you have to form your trust in the United States or an English country to have a trust, and that's where it gets complicated when you live in a non-common law country.
Now, when you do have a trust, though, that it eliminates really you owning anything. The trust, and I'm not a tax guy. But if you get a trust, everything goes into that trust. There's a fiduciary. There's somebody who's appointed as the trustee. And money goes into that. And they own the businesses. The trust owns the home. The trust owns everything. So if the trust owns everything, you're not really taxed, are you?
Correct. You're not really taxed when you pass away. The assets are owned by the trust, and they are not subject to any type of death tax or gift tax or inheritance tax.
Because nobody died.
Nobody died. And in some states, you know, each state has their own set of trust laws. In some states, the trust can last forever. For example, in Alaska, they last forever. In other states, like Nevada, they can last for 365 years.
There's another thing that a trust is, I think, is excellent for also. Let's say that that you buy a home 15 years ago, and I just pick a number. The home is worth $25,000. Now, today, that same home is worth $200,000. Normally, if you don't have a trust, you're going to get taxed on the difference between the two if you sell that home. But if you have a trust and you pass away, the surviving spouse gets to have the basis of that home moves up, let me see if I can say this right, the moves up to whatever current market value is. So that $25,000 home is now considered $200,000 in the trust, and if the home is sold, there isn't any profit made on it.
That's absolutely right. And in California, we have one more rule for trust. Back to your example, the house was bought 25 years ago for $25,000. In California and a few other states, the property tax cost remains at $25,000 with a small increase for inflation. So if you could keep a trust for 365 years, you could have a very low property tax on that trust. And that's the other advantage. So there's income tax, there's estate and gift tax, but there's also local property taxes.
Well, by the way, if we talk taxes across the board, not just a personal tax or an income tax, there are so many taxes right now, I truly believe that we probably pay 50-60% of total income in taxes, gas taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a tremendous amount, and it's just the ability to maneuver through. Going to a CPA or a professional tax person is like going to an attorney. You don't want to go to court without the attorney, and you don't want to deal with the IRS without somebody who knows the ground rules and can move you through. So I really guess the question here would be, if you have a trust, Brian, will that help you with international income and the taxation of it if it comes in?
Well, trusts are unique. Yes, it will. The way the trust helps is a trust is a legal person that is created without the consent of a government. So we think of corporations, and to get a corporation, you file papers with your state government, California, Arizona, wherever it may be, and they give you a corporate charter. Same with a LLC. That's a type of a company. Once again, the state gives you that existence.
Limited liability.
Yeah, right. Same with some partnerships. They are actually, in effect, approved by a state filing. A trust is an agreement between really two parties, myself and somebody who I trust who's going to hold the assets on behalf of myself and my family. And a trust can move from one state to another state merely by changing the trustee. It can also move from one country to the other country merely by changing the trustee. So if somebody's coming to the United States, they plan to work here for 10 or 20, 30 years, or they have a family with people in different parts of the world, you can form a trust wherever you want, wherever they have the best tax advantage. If the tax laws change, you just move your trust to a new country.
Let me tell you one of the things I like about a trust. As you were talking, I was thinking about this. When somebody passes away without a trust, they have to go through probate. And if you have a trust, it eliminates probate. You don't die intestate.
Correct.
Yeah, and
in some states like California, that fee is set by law, and it's a very large fee. The fee could be 5% of the value of the estate. So even a state of $300,000, which is a home in California, can pay a fee of $15,000 just for the right of going to court.
Okay, so in essence, one thing to look at with this, if you go to probate, the trustee is appointed by the court, and you have no idea who that is. And if you do it before that happens, you can choose who you want as your fiduciary or your trustee in that. And there's so many things that a trust can do. Now, is that one of the major answers for international taxation?
Yes, a trust is the key entity for international or cross-border families or cross-border business. And the reason is because our tax law provides a trust a preferred tax plan or tax laws over a company. And most nations give the trust the same type of status. So when you have the trust owning other companies or partnerships and you have all the wealth going into the trust, you avoid the estate tax, you protect the assets in case anybody in your family gets sued. Almost every trust is an asset protection trust. It doesn't take much to have a trust have that status. So you can really protect your family in case somebody in the family maybe is an alcoholic and they drink and drive. They'll have their insurance, but they won't be able to take all of that, the wealth of the family. And it's important. It's really an important family planning tool.
Yeah, Brian, we're starting to run out of time. One last question before we go, though. There's two kinds of trust. There's a revocable and irrevocable. Is an irrevocable trust something that you better really take a look at before you get into it? Because once you've got it, you've got it, and the fiduciary's there, and that's the end of it.
Well, you know, that's the case in many states in the United States. But about 20 states have a new trust law that allows even a trust which you said you cannot revoke or cannot amend to actually be changed in a court hearing. And the court hearing is very quick if everybody in the family agrees. So if you did create a trust and maybe somebody ends up getting Alzheimer's and you want to really help them out, you could go to the court and get that trust changed.
Okay, so it is possible to remove the irrevocability of it at the time.
Yes.
Wonderful. Hey, Brian Dooley, we're just about out of time. Is there a website we can find you at to get the book?
Yes. No, I think the easiest place is on Amazon. Go to Amazon and type in Brian Dooley, CPA, and you'll see my book and my author page. And it's on Kindle, it's on hardback, and it's just a great book.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Ding dong. And if this band don't desert us,
then there's nothing in the world can hurt us. Long as we're singing our song. Put some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm.
Hey, thanks for listening tonight. And if you're listening on the web, tell your local radio stations about the show. That's the way we grow. And that's what you call networking. I'll make Michael Ray Dresser, whatever I am. And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Long as we're singing.